Friday. My name's Dave. I'm an alcoholic. I think you probably want Caitlin to come up here and talk the rest of the time. She's pretty funny. Unfortunately, my story's not that funny because I get real serious about this. But before we start, if you would join me in a short prayer to invite your higher power into this meeting. Thank you. It took a long time to get from the time I was born to getting sober at 60 years old. Just shows you it can happen to anybody. And as you'll find out, that 60 years, I went to my first AA meeting when I was 48, so I ran hard. My sobriety date is July 17th, 2004. I have a home group, Back to Basics, which meets at Bayshore Presbyterian on Thursday at noon. You're all invited. I have a sponsor with 44 years, and his sponsor has 36 years, and I'm very blessed to hang out with, in some meetings where you have four guys that have 170 years between them. It's pretty impressive, and you can pick up some great wisdom from them. I keep hoping it's going to rub off on me some of the wisdom anyway. What it was like, what happened, what it's like now. I found myself on the Outer Banks of North Carolina, where I'm from, in a small house. And the day I moved in, I closed the blinds. I wouldn't answer the door. I wouldn't answer the phone. All I could do was sit there and drink. There were several things that happened when I was going to AA early on. I couldn't relate to people, and I didn't believe in the book, and I had a problem with the God thing. So this part has to do with really being a non-believer. Because had I read the book after what I've just told you, you would have found this on 539 of the fourth edition. My self-imposed hell was my own home, unbathed in the same night clothes day after day, afraid of the phone, the doorbell, and the darkness. If the clock said 6, I wouldn't know whether it was morning or evening. Days ran into each other in an agonizing blur. I crawled to bed, drank when I came to, and sat shivering in fear for some unknown tragedy that I thought was about to descend on me. I remember wailing because I couldn't make coffee, sitting curled in a corner, trying to sort out how I could commit suicide without making a mess. I might have tried, but I was afraid no one would find me before I started to stink. That's what it was like for me at the end. And I found myself curled in a fetal position in a blackened bedroom, drinking, of course, crying on the floor. And I asked, at that point, I asked God to change my life. Now, note, I didn't ask him to help me quit drinking. I just wanted him to change my life. And lo and behold, in his time, that happened. Both happened. It was a long way to that point. I was born and raised in North Carolina. My father's family's from the mountains, and my mother's family's from New England. Now, how they got together, I don't know. This is a Depression era. And so the way I behaved in one environment was totally different from the way I behaved in another environment. I felt a little different. I was born with a congenital eye defect. My eyes were crossed. I had my first eye surgery at 9 months. So So I was a kid at 3 years old running around wearing glasses with a patch on my eye. And some people can relate. or you just got the image, huh? Needless to say, that spawned a lot of difficulties. A lot of teasing, a lot of fights, so on and so forth. I did very well in school, except for in conduct. You remember, well, I don't know how they did it when you guys were growing up, but they would rate you A, B, C, D, or F on conduct just the way they would on the grades, and most of mine were D's and F's. And since my mother was a college professor, things did not go well when I got home. I didn't fit in there. I didn't know whether I was a bad person or beating the bad guy like Caitlin was talking about, or just being the smart ass trying to answer the questions in front of everybody. I became very active in church work in my youth and then through high school, and decided that I was going to go into the ministry. Came to Florida Southern College and got a degree in religion. And at that point in time, I had the luxury of being able to go to school on a work scholarship, which required that I be a licensed Methodist preacher for 5 years. Now, I didn't go to seminary. Couldn't perform the rites, the sacraments. But I was in that age, that college age, where the things that I had learned and taken for rote and just accepted in my youth, I began to question. And there would be a lot of philosophical discussions about God and so on and so forth. And this was a period of time when there was this little thing going on in Southeast Asia called Vietnam. So I went in the military, got commissioned through ROTC. I spent 2.5 years in Vietnam, came home, went to an infantry career course, which was designed to help promote me along the way on up the ladder, went to the Command and General Staff College and so on and so forth. And moved to Fort Bragg, North Carolina, bought a house, and 30 days later I found out I was being involuntarily put out of service. And therein started the depression and the first real big resentment. At that point in time, I drank a lot. I mean, in the military, it was like you played hard, you worked hard, it was encouraged. At that time, if you were an officer and you had officer's call and you didn't show up, it reflected on your efficiency report and a socialization column. So it was encouraged. But I had a lot of great experiences in the military. And after I had an 8-year break in service, after being involuntarily put out, until I could get back into the reserves, and I joined it with the idea of it being a paying hobby for me. And it ended up that I got to be on General Schwarzkopf's staff during Desert Shield and Storm and deployed overseas and was called up again for Somalia and a few other little things that were going on. So here I was in that 8 years between service. I went to law school. And I worked as a lawyer for a while in a private practice, and then we had an accidental pregnancy and decided I had to get a real job, and I went to work doing tobacco litigation. And after that, I did the rest of my career doing social services work, what you call Department of Family Services down here, doing adult and child abuse and neglect, child support enforcement, termination of parental rights, adoptions, and so on and so forth. Got pretty heavy emotionally. So here I was that day, that night, sitting curled in the corner. I'd been a Green Beret lieutenant colonel. I was a lawyer, you know. what's wrong. And another section in the book that talks about we were having trouble with personal relationships. Well, I was going through a very acrimonious divorce, but I'd been married 28 years. Of course, that was 7 years per wife. And that doesn't count the time that we were separated and apart. We couldn't control our emotional natures. Well, some of the things that I was going through were resulting in my being homicidal and suicidal to the point of actually acting out on some of the homicidal thoughts. Along about this time, chronologically, I was diagnosed with delayed onset of post-traumatic stress disorder. And I said, yeah, well, I may have that, but it's not from the war. It's from this damn divorce that's going on and all these lawyers and DX and the judges. And, you know, my life was unmanageable. But it was not because of alcohol. It was because of, you know, I was taking birth control pills at that time because the way I was getting screwed, I knew I was going to get pregnant sometime or another. It was bound to happen. That was my take on stuff. We had a feeling of uselessness. God, I had days I wouldn't go out of that house except to the liquor store. We were full of fear. We were unhappy. We couldn't seem to be of real help to other people like I really wanted to be. I was so self-centered, all my woes. And it's like Bill says in his story, no words can tell of the loneliness and despair I've found in that bitter morass of self-pity. Now, grant you, I was justified. And in the 12 and 12, it talks about unjustified resentments and justified resentments. All of mine were justified. Just like it says in the 12 and 12, they were all justified. So, I will tell you now, that, just as an aside, that had it not been for my dog, I would have died there in that place. I did indeed attempt suicide. As you can tell, I screwed that up too. And some people mess up a wet dream. But what happened? A couple of years after that night, I was in contact with another guy that I was in service with down here at MacDill. And he was talking about selling his condominium. And he and his wife had me over several times when I'd be deployed down here. I said, what are you going to do with the condo? He said, I'm going to sell it. Well, I'm thinking, I remember MacDill. Beaches, babes, and booze. That was my mantra. So I said, not till I get down there. So it ended up that I bought his condominium. It came about that both my parents had passed. I had come into a little money so that I could afford to do this. Rented it back to him for a year. Then I came to Florida and started renovating the condo. It soon became clear to me that a couple of the guys that were really doing the labor didn't really like having me around in the daytime. Now, this is something I should tell you, too. The guy that owned the condo before me was the homeowner's president for like 20 years. And there were two guys that always came up there for happy hour every afternoon right after work. And they'd sit there and they'd drink from 5 till 7:30, whenever. And so I told him, well, you know, that doesn't have to change. So I end up down here, and I'm going to AA meetings. I did 184 meetings. I'm sorry, I did 146 meetings in 80 days. Why? first meeting I went to. I found myself reaching. I was just back from Saudi Arabia and Kuwait, and the doors were locked. Locks had been changed. The bank account was cleaned out, and papers had been filed saying that I had abandoned my family. So a friend of mine let me stay in his apartment. Man, what a great deal. Was I lucky? I'm drawing unemployment now. It's great. Never occurred to me that I was actually homeless. Never occurred to me that I had no real income. So I found myself about 10:30 one morning reaching for a drink, and I thought, and I wasn't working the night shift then, and I thought, well, this is a little unusual. I think I'll go to one of those AA meetings and find out what they think about this, and I did. And for those of you that are new, my experience at the first AA meeting was something like this. Walk in, be greeted, you know, look around, grab a seat, see the 12 commandments on the wall. They start with a prayer. Next thing I know, they're talking about, if you want what we have, what the hell you got? I don't know. I can't see it. I don't understand. But because I'm there and I want to be accepted by everybody, I'm Dave. I'm an alcoholic. Then they passed the basket. Then they closed with the prayer. And I walked out of there wondering what kind of religious sect this thing was. I was totally disappointed. And they kept talking about God. And what had happened in my life, parallel life, was that I had, although I had gotten a degree in religion, through that period of time when I was in service, I had no connection with God other than foxhole prayers. In June of 1983, I had a burning bush experience. And for about 4 years, I walked the walk. And in terms of my gods, I won't say requirements, but needs, my needs to support my God. And life was wonderful. And gradually, like an alcoholic that goes out and relapses, I know about relapses, I quit praying quite so much. I quit going to quite so many meetings. I didn't read the book. I didn't talk to a sponsor. And the next thing I knew, because this church did offer a sponsor, it was an interesting arrangement. But the next thing you know, I'm off on the possum track, running Dave's life, forgetting all about God. So when I'm laying there on that floor that night, there's been several years, 12 years as a matter of fact, of when I've been thinking about the God thing. And I'm saying, how can God forgive me when he gave me everything he possibly could and showed me everything that was really good in life and that I could have it and gave it to me? And I walked away from it. How do I get that forgiveness? I don't know if any of you have ever had that problem. But my first sponsor suggested to me, well, you're pretty damn arrogant to be deciding what your God will and will not do for you. You're taking away, you're defining him in a limited role. So that got me to thinking a little bit. So as you can tell, my life had become unmanageable. And when I'm in those meetings that I'm going to off and on, and I got to tell you about the white chips. They're deadly. Like I said, I was living on the Outer Banks, going to this small meeting, and they finally asked me to bring back some of the white chips because they were running out. And I don't say that to brag. I'm saying that to emphasize the extent to which my higher power was willing to go to drag my butt into sobriety. Um, fast forwarding again, coming back down here to Florida. Well, I was not insane. That was the other thing, step two, right? I wasn't insane. I don't do insane things. But yet I'd had a psychiatrist tell me that one of my little episodes was called alcohol-induced dissociative reaction. That was a circumstance where cops were involved and all kinds of things were involved. I was having a flashback to Vietnam, alcohol-induced. Told this by a professional. I was seeing a therapist, mental health specialist, primarily for PTSD, and he kept telling me about, well, you're an alcoholic. So I went to this treatment center, four-week deal. I don't have but 2 weeks of insurance. You go 2 weeks, and you're gone. So we tried a second one. Same kind of thing. 2 weeks, and you're gone. Eventually, I ended up in a four-week program up in Salem, Virginia, with the VA. And, you know, the first 2 weeks, it took me the first 2 weeks to straighten them out on how they should be running their show, because they just did not understand the way things are supposed to operate. They just didn't understand. And besides, they were all alcoholics. So after those treatment center experiences, and there was another sign about dysfunctional and insanity. It's hard when you're a senior officer in the local VFW post to get barred from the bar for life. And you go in there and you drink from 8 o'clock in the morning when they open till 8 o'clock at night, and then you decide to go out on the island and have a drink. And guess what? You drive through a checkpoint, DUI checkpoint. No problem. Drive right on through. Go out, and I toss down about 3 or 4 gin and tonics, doubles, of course. Then I turn around, and I got to go back over the same only bridge to get off the island. And I forgot that that roadblock was there, and I'd had my window rolled up. It was cold. So by the time I got back, they just smelled that, and I got arrested for DUI. That's why I was going to meetings down here, because I was in the process of moving down here, and I thought, well, you know, Judge, no prior arrests. Look at all the AA meetings I've been going to. You know, no harm, no foul. Besides, I'm moving. Here's my library card, my voter registration card, the deed, the da-da-da-da-da. Well, another act of the grace of God was that case was dismissed. It was entrapment, because I was the only vehicle driving down that sidewalk that they stopped that night. They were singling me out. So my routine after I get to Florida is I'm going to meetings. You know, don't drink and go to meetings. So I went to meetings and then drank. I thought that was within the purview of the rules. So I'd go down here to the Longhorn, have a couple drinks after the 8 o'clock meeting, have dinner, a couple glasses of wine with dinner, a couple of drinks after dinner. By that time, they're closed. The wait staff's going out. I'm going out with them. 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning, I'm coming back in. Next day, same routine. And I walk in there one night, and Glenn, the bartender, is way down at the other end of the bar, and he sees me and just nods to me, and he brings me a drink. And he sets it down in front of me, and I didn't want it. And I haven't wanted a drink since then. Let's read about page 88. That is what you might call a miracle. We will seldom be interested in liquor. If tempted, we recoil from it as from a hot flame. We react sanely and normally, and we will find that this has happened automatically. We will see that our new attitude toward liquor has been given us without any thought or effort on our part. It just comes. That is the miracle of it. We are not fighting it, neither are we avoiding temptation. We feel as though we had been placed in a position of neutrality, safe and protected. We have not even sworn off. Instead, the problem has been removed. Now, I share that experience with you because I don't know an awful lot of people who got sober sitting at a bar. But my belief is God could and would if he were sought. And I would submit to you that that night that I found myself in that fetal position, curled up, begging for God to change my life, that he not only changed my life with material things, but he took away the desire to drink. That is the miracle of it. And it is purely the grace of God. Well, what's happened since then? I got a sponsor, worked the steps. My first sponsor was a guy that many of you know, Craig D. Very spiritual in nature. Very active in service work and got me involved in service work. To a great extent. Some of you may have seen me at roundups or Sober Stock or Steps to Freedom, some of those places. I have sponsees that I sponsor. I work at the club, 3333 Club. I do a lot of work there. And I've been active and active and active in it ever since I got in. 12-step calls. We hear all the old stories about the 12-step calls and never had any quite like that, like the old-timers talk about, but still make them in one way or another. It still happens on a rare basis. So now I have a home. I'm sober. My son actually invited me to his wedding and let me attend. My brother and I are beginning to rekindle our relationship because I burned a lot of bridges. I hurt a lot of people. I did a lot of destruction. I always knew there was a power greater than myself, but it wasn't this insanity. That night I made the decision, even though it was in desperation, it was a gift of desperation, to turn my will and my life over to the care of God. That was renewed when I did the third step with my sponsor. The Fearless Moral Inventory. I'm still finding things that pop up daily, not quite daily, but frequently. Things, events, and people that I haven't thought about before where I need to make amends. Turning my will and my life over to the care of God, asking him to remove all my defects of character, praying for his will for me and the power to carry that out. Are the things that really drive me today. And it's given me a great deal of joy. Uh, 10, 11, and 12 are just, for me, just the whole deal. Continued to make conscious contact with God as I understood him. In order to do that, I've gone to a lot of conferences, some men's spiritual retreats. I've been blessed to have the opportunity to go to some of Sandy's retreats that he had for men. And the other thing is working at the roundup. I have had a chance to get to know some of the speakers that come in on a little bit different level. Not that I'm bragging or name-dropping. But there's this sense that you feel, not that you're in the presence of God, but you can sense this overwhelming commitment to the program and to the joy in their life because of the program. And it is so inspiring. I would encourage all of you to really do a lot of service work. It is so rewarding. I always want to close the meeting by reading a quote from Bill Wilson. And see if you can relate to this, as do I. So I shall be content if I can remind myself and anyone who would hear that AA is not a personal success story. It is instead the story of our colossal human failures, now converted into the happiest kind of usefulness by the divine alchemy, the living Christ.